Welcome to your Right to Speak discussions on child and youth rights, advocacy, and social justice. This is episode 20. I'm your host, Salvatore. My co-host, Jen, is not able to join us today because she is studying for a test. So good luck to you, Jen. I know you're going to be here in spirit. Today's episode, we will continue on the topic of immigration and refugee, and we'll be talking with a Osgoode Law School student, Pierre-André. I'm very excited to continue on this conversation. I've been particularly green on this whole subject, so I'm eager to learn more. Pierre-André, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. Well, I'm a PhD candidate here in Osgoode Hall Law School at York University. My research focuses on decision-making in the refugee resettlement framework in Canada, and I also work as a refugee lawyer, mainly on refugee resettlement cases.
Well, thank you for taking the time out to speak with me today. You've mentioned your what your research background, and do you want to explain what your thesis is on?
Sure. So I look at basically the rule of law, access to justice, and quality of decision making in the Canadian refugee resettlement framework. And what that means is I'm basically looking at a few court decisions and doing some interviews. I'm interested in knowing what do we see in terms of trends in quality of decision making. What is the dialogue between the courts and the bureaucracy in terms of the evolution of the law, and what kind of access to appeal mechanisms that failed refugee claimants have in the refugee resettlement framework.
So you mentioned the access part. Do you find that within your research there are some gaps within that access?
Certainly. So what happens in the resettlement framework is any refugee who is rejected by the visa officer, it may be a government-assisted refugee or a privately sponsored refugee, they basically have no recourse to appeal that decision. The only route they can take is to seek a judicial review of the case. But that happens in Canadian courts. Mm-hmm. It's a very costly process. It takes many years to complete. And very few refugees who remain in a refugee situation abroad have the financial resources or the knowledge required to initiate that process. So just to give you an example, in the inland refugee claim system, so that's refugees who come here by their own means, they make a claim at the Immigration and Refugee Board, and if they're rejected, well, now most of them have access to an appeal, an internal appeal within that administrative framework, but then they also have access to judicial review. And over the years, we saw that about 20% of those refugees were making a judicial review claim or application. And what happens if they're successful with the courts is the decision, the initial decision is not reversed, but they sort of get another kick at the can. The decision is sent back to the administrative decision maker, and then they make a second decision. So it works fairly well in the inland system because these refugees have access to legal aid. They're already here. But in the resettlement framework, the failed refugee applicants, they're not here and they don't have access to legal aid. So instead of, let's say, 20% of failed applicants who seek judicial review, we see 1 to 3% of the failed applicants. that seek judicial review. And also, we see a sort of reverse trend where of that very small number of refugees who are able to access that review process, more than half are successful or have their case settled by the government. And just to compare that with the inland process again, the success rate there is less than 7%. Right? So that kind of raises a number of other questions. Why are so many of these refugees successful at judicial review when the court applies a very restrictive standard? Often they require they don't necessarily look for an incorrect decision, but they will only quash the decision if it was really unreasonable. So there's a really restrictive criteria that's applied, and there's even more restrictions, legal restrictions in play, because it's a process that unfolds overseas. It's considered purely administrative and discretionary. Whereas in the inland program, we have this so-called quasi-judicial board making these decisions, and the court will tend to be a bit less deferent, right? So all of what my preliminary research point to is that there's a very small number of of failed refugees who access the judicial review system, and a large number of those cases are successful. And that in turn raises questions in terms of the quality of decision making by the visa officers. Why are so many of these cases successful? Are the visa officers properly trained? Is it the way they conduct interviews? We don't really know at this point.
That sounds very interesting. Just to clarify for my listeners, because I know that they may not necessarily have a legal background, do you want to just very briefly define what judicial review is for the listeners?
Right, judicial review. So each anyone in Canada who is an individual affected by an administrative decision, be it by a provincial or a federal agency, board, commission, or a agent of a department, has a right, an inherent right, to seek judicial review of that decision. So what that means, you will go to a provincial court if it's a provincial decision maker you're dealing with, or to the Federal Court of Canada if you're dealing with a federal matter, and immigration is a federal matter. So at judicial review, what the court will basically look at is, was the decision reasonable? Was it intelligible? Were the the principles of procedural fairness followed, right? So it's not really like an appeal, where in an appeal the judge will kind of think, well, was the decision correct or was it incorrect? Here, the courts are very deferent to the administrative bodies. Often they're specialized decision-making bodies, so they ask the more broad question, was the decision reasonable? Was the decision intelligible? Were the principles sort of reasonably applied, right? And then if you have a successful judicial review, then the decision is sent back to the initial administrative decision maker, and then they make a second decision on the same case. Now, they can still take a negative decision, right? It doesn't guarantee a different outcome. It just gives you the right to have a second decision.
Thank you so much. I've actually just taken a class on, or I'm still in a class on administrative law,
Oh,
so
okay.
it's very helpful. So let's move a little bit more into our topic, because I know we went off on a tangent a little bit on judicial review. Now, I know my understanding is that you are working with or have helped create the refugee sponsoring support program.
Right, so the Refugee Sponsorship Support Program. I've been, I didn't create the
Okay.
program, but I've been involved with the sort of Toronto chapter of that initiative pretty much since the early beginnings of the program, and I'm also on the advisory board for the Toronto chapter.
Great.
The Refugee Sponsorship Support Program is a sort of network of pro bono lawyers and students that was put together in the fall of 2015, and it started out of the University of Ottawa. There's Professor Jennifer Bond over there who heads the refugee hub, and that's kind of where the program started. It started really small. They were kind of advertising. They were, I'm sorry, training lawyers to do these kinds of resettlement applications, because very few lawyers, in fact, before this program started, had kind of experience with this type of immigration
Really?
application. And so that program, yeah, started because the Syrian movement had started. There were a lot of people who wanted to sponsor, but it's a really complicated process. It's a very onerous and daunting application package, and there was a need for lawyers in local communities to be able to deal with that, and
Right.
also pro bono lawyers, because these sponsors did not have, obviously, the funds to
Right.
hire a private lawyer. Now that program has sort of mushroomed and now exists in more than 10 cities
Right.
across Canada. It operates kind of a little differently in each community. It's kind of very community specific and need specific, and it depends
Great.
on which institutions are there. But the basic principle is to provide pro bono legal services to refugee sponsors. In Toronto, it's the, I think, the largest RSSP chapter in the country, and it's been it's evolved a little differently here, mainly because of the presence of another organization called Lifeline Syria. So the RSSP teamed up with Lifeline Syria initially to basically offer clinics and train lawyers where the lawyers, the what we call the Canadian contact, the family contact of the refugee being sponsored, and often a law student would come together and make an application happen. But the RSSP is much offers services for all populations, not only the Syrian populations, but it's been really Syrian heavy in Toronto because of the recent
Right,
movement.
right, right.
Yeah.
So since we've got on the topic of Syrian refugees, I have found that there's been some like backlash from the media and the public, and they seem to be a bit divided on the Syrian refugee crisis, and Canada's role or approach to the process. And one of the main criticisms was that Canada had brought too many Syrian refugees here. So I was wondering, like, what are your thoughts on this?
Right. I guess it really depends what you read and who you yeah, the kind of news that you're reading. I think the Canadian response has been quite favorable to the Syrian movement specifically. I think there will always be people who
Right.
oppose increase in immigration levels. I think a lot of that discourse is, in my opinion, based on a lot of myths and misconceptions rather than fact about immigration and refugee protection. My own view is that that number has not been too high. There were 40,000 Syrians who came, well, a little before 2016,
Right.
in 2016, and a little after. You know, it's less than a tenth of a percent of the population. We saw similar numbers in the late 70s with the Vietnamese population.
Right.
There was another surge in private sponsorship towards the end of the 80s. One other thing to note, I guess, is that the levels for 2017 have gone down a lot, and the number of refugees that the Canada is going to bring is much lower. I think it's something like 7,500 government-assisted refugees and about 16,000 privately sponsored refugees. I think Canada has the responsibility to share the global burden of refugees and to help as many refugees as possible. That's the humanitarian argument. I think there's also an economic argument to be made. We have a terribly aging population,
mm-hmm.
and we have a need for workers. And I think immigration and refugee protection is the probably the major solution to that to a major problem. I would like to see immigration. Family reunification in immigration numbers increase, and also the numbers of refugees increase, maybe not necessarily to the levels of 2016, but I still think they could be higher. And an important aspect of that is there is currently a very high interest for private sponsorship, and we'll talk more about that later, I'm sure, but I would at least like to see the government kind of fully take advantage of the interest for refugee sponsorship and allow all of those who want to sponsor to sponsor immediately. So, and remove the restrictions that have been imposed on refugee sponsorship, and we can talk about that later, and also remove the caps that have been put on the numbers that can be sponsored by some types of sponsor. And I think that's necessary to ensure that the programs, remain sustainable
mm-hmm.
in the long term.
So you've mentioned sponsorship a couple of times, so let's just dive into that.
Okay.
So I guess just for the listeners, could you explain what the difference is between private sponsorship and government-assisted refugees?
So, I'll start with the government-assisted refugees because it's kind of what most people think of in most countries about refugee resettlement. So a government-assisted refugee will be a refugee that's selected by the government, and the refugees... settlement in the country is financially supported by the government.
Okay,
so basically they're funded and they're selected by the government. That's
mm-hmm.
why we call them government-assisted refugees. What we have in Canada is a unique program called the Private Sponsorship
mm-hmm.
of Refugees Program. It really is unique in the world. It's kind of other countries are starting to adopt something similar, but nothing to this scale that Canada currently has. It was established in the late 70s and was really successful with the resettlement of a large number of Vietnamese people
mm-hmm.
when the program was launched. And basically what the program means is individuals or groups of individuals or organizations or community groups basically come together, and they can select a refugee that they know of through their network or through a family member of the refugee, and commit to assisting the refugee as they settle for 12 months, which includes financial support
mm-hmm.
for 12 months.
Thank you. So I've read in some articles that there are possibly some challenges to private sponsorship. Would you agree with that? Do you know what some of these challenges are?
Sure. There, I think the private sponsorship of refugees is alive and well and continues to play an important role for Canada's refugee scheme. But there are ongoing challenges, and I think changes that should be made to ensure the sustainability of the program. And one of that challenges has to do with the issue of additionality and naming. Those were the two sort of founding principles of the programs in the late 70s, and are the two principles that sort of refugee advocacy organizations push for. Basically, it means that privately sponsored spaces should always be over and above the government commitments to refugees. And sponsors also should always be able to name the sponsor, I'm sorry, the refugee they want to sponsor. And what we've seen over the years is, a sort of constant erosion of these two principles. We've seen the appearance of the so-called blended programs, where the government names the refugee for the sponsor and partially funds the sponsorship. That's called a blended program. It's not it's not a problem in and of itself, but it becomes a problem if if those blended spaces are kind of counted as government spaces, and then the government is sort of simply using the private sponsors' resources and interest to fulfill its own humanitarian commitments. And for example, we see that this year and I'm kind of switching topics here.
That's okay.
we see that and this gets again to the issue of additionality is we see the government making commitments for additional settlement places. But often these numbers, when you see the breakdown of those numbers, sometimes 10% of them will be through the government-assisted program, but 90% will be through the private sponsorship program. So there is a problem with the government kind of unloading its sort of humanitarian commitments on civil society like that. And I do think that if the private sponsors don't see that their sponsorship efforts are resulting in an extra space or in additional protection, that they may lose ultimate interest in the program, and that could really hinder the development of the program. There's also the issue of long timelines. Normally, it can take for about it can take about 3 to 4 years for a case to be completed. The timelines were really shortened for the Syrian program. A lot of resources from other visa offices around the world were sort of reallocated to the countries around Syria, and these cases were basically expedited. But for other refugee populations, and now for the Syrian population, we've sort of reverted to the old to the old ways, and it can still take now 2 to 4 years for a case to settle. That's obviously a real problem for the refugees themselves, who are still in a displaced situation overseas. They don't have access to financial support during that time. They can be deported in the meantime, and there's also a program. It's also a problem for the sponsors here, who initially sign up for a 12-month commitment, it turns into a 5-year commitment. People and their situation can change in the meantime. People move to other localities, and that just creates more challenges. So one really simple answer to that problem would be to reduce those timelines. I understand the government has is investing resources to reduce those timelines, but they're still way too long.
So we're at that time that we have to start wrapping up. It's been a great conversation so far. It kind of saddens me that we're ending this soon. But I have to ask you, this is how I close all my episodes, and the listeners know it's coming. What does advocacy mean to you?
Well, that's an interesting question. And it's also an question of ethics and research for me as well. I obviously I do consider myself a refugee rights advocate. At the same time, I do academic research in the area. So I guess the first part of my answer is I think someone who's in my position, and I think you are in the same position as well, always needs to be mindful of the type of work that we're doing and taking a good look at the kind of research that we're doing and always asking the question, am I being objective here?
Right.
And I guess the other part of my answer here has to do more specifically with working with refugees. I think what kind of compels me to work, to do advocacy work in this area for refugees abroad is in I guess Canadian society, they're probably the group of people who have less or the least voice in the public discourse, right? So part of the advocacy work that why it's so important is precisely because they are absent. We constantly take decisions without their input, right? Because they're by definitions not members of our society,
right?
Yeah, that's a motivation that certainly drives a lot of the work that I do, and certainly the research that I do as well.
I can totally relate to both of those aspects. As someone who is also researching around child and youth rights and child and youth participation, I often have to make sure that I'm writing objectively and I'm not bringing in fully my values. I guess that's the issue for all researchers in academia, right?
Certainly.
And I can totally relate to the last part that you were saying, because often I found is that children and youth, their voices often get left out in the conversation as well. So I can totally relate to what you're saying.
And there are youth refugees as well.
That's right, exactly. Yeah, so. So thank you very much for taking the time out. I think it's a great way to end. Would you like to say anything else before we wrap up?
No, not really.
That's okay. We really went through a lot of great topics, and you know, thank you again for taking the time out to speak with me. Your right to speak will be posted on the second Wednesday of every month. Thank you again for taking the time out. If you are a child or youth that would like to be on the show, or if you have an idea of what topic we should be talking about, please email me or Jen at yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. That's yourrighttospeak@gmail.com. Let's raise awareness together.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.